Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There are a lot of ways to try to measure the government's bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Sheer dollar amounts, share prices, bond yields. What about this, though? It's cheaper to get a mortgage today than it was on Friday. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity, online at us.areva.com. And by Cleveland Clinic, working to redefine healthcare and the patient experience with the new Miller Family Pavilion and Glickman Tower. More at meetthebuildings.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Monday, the 8th of September, and it's great to have you here. Say what you will about the bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac this weekend, but in committing what could wind up being as much as $200 billion in taxpayer money, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson wasn't pulling any punches.
It would not have been in the best interest of taxpayers for the Treasury to simply make an equity investment in these enterprises in their current form.
In other words, just buying company stock wasn't going to do it, so Paulson went all in. On top of the $200 billion I just mentioned, the government gets options to buy new stock. It'll step in to backstop the mortgages Fannie and Freddie already hold, and a federal regulator is going to be running the two government-sponsored entities day to day. So congratulations on your new investment, John and Jane Q taxpayer. As far as what it actually means for you and me, here's Marketplace's Janet Babin from North Carolina Public Radio.
If you're trying to get a mortgage, the bailout could make it easier. Now that the government's officially backing Fannie and Freddie's housing debt, investors may be more willing to buy it. That could make more credit available and get more houses sold. Tom LaMalfa is with mortgage research firm Wholesale Access.
The rescue's biggest boost for consumers really may come from a renewed confidence from banks for mortgages.
Another silver lining for consumers could be lower mortgage rates and fees. Josh Rosner is managing director at Graham Fisher & Company. He says banks will be more willing to negotiate with qualified home buyers. That's because banks know that Fannie and Freddie are ready to purchase the loans and repackage them.
If you have an adjustable rate mortgage, it could have some benefit for you, and it may certainly make it easier for people to refinance.
But not all experts think the bailout will benefit home buyers. Richard Beauvais at investment bank Ladenburg Thalmann says eventually the takeover will reduce the number of mortgages available. Starting in 2010, Fannie and Freddie will have to drop their mortgage holdings by 10% each year.
There will be less money available for mortgages because there will be less Fannie and Freddie.
And the rescue won't come cheap. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said it would be difficult to know the ultimate cost. What we do know is that taxpayers will foot the bill. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Picking up on that point, it is absolutely not a stretch to say there is more we don't know now about what's going to happen in the mortgage finance markets than we do, starting with the eventual price tag Janet just mentioned. To get another perspective on that, we called Karen Shaw Petru at Federal Financial Analytics in Washington, D.C. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
What do you think the odds are of this not working out the way Secretary Paulson wants it to, and of taxpayers getting stuck holding the bag?
Well, the odds are not small. I mean, nothing has worked so far, so I think we need to be cautious about this. Treasury is doing the best it can with a set of really crummy options. It didn't want to do this. Now it has, and I think we all need to hope that this works because it's hard to even contemplate what else would have to happen if this doesn't take hold in the market.
Well, go ahead and contemplate. What else might happen?
The next step, if Fannie and Freddie can't make it through the conservatorship, I guess would be a receivership. Treasury right now has set this up so that would never happen. And a receivership is like a bankruptcy. The shareholders are completely cut out and the debt goes on to the federal budget and it's essentially nationalized.
I suppose it's important to point out that as of right now, there's no federal money in this thing yet. There's no federal money in Fannie or Freddie right now.
No, there will be at least $2 billion, $1 billion each in each of the GSEs very, very soon. And I would expect a fair amount to follow. What Treasury is hoping is that even if they put the $200 billion or more, that the underlying assets at Fannie and Freddie are worth enough so that the net cost of all of this to the federal government doesn't approximate the actual outlay. That's really the bet, and it's a high-risk bet because of the way the mortgage market is these days.
Speaking of that, help me understand how this fixes or at least goes some way toward making the housing market better.
You have to think of the housing market as having two problems. One is liquidity. By promising all this assistance, including a new window, the Treasury has basically said mortgage market, financial markets, don't worry. As much money as Fannie and Freddie need, we'll keep the taps open. And that's a big help. That should reduce the funding cost and also mortgage cost. But there's another problem, and that's solvency. Because a lot of the mortgages Fannie and Freddie hold are going to go to foreclosure or are already in foreclosure. And there's nothing Treasury can do to make that better. That's already happened. The new loans might be better, but we've got to work through all the old loans. And that's really the risk to taxpayers.
I wanted to ask a question about the mechanics of this. The government has stepped in. They're going to backstop Fannie and Freddie for the next year. But then they're going to start reducing their exposure in the mortgage markets by about 10% a year. Is this the government finally getting out of the business of fostering home ownership in this country?
I think that remains to be seen. The plan is to run the portfolio down, as you rightly say, starting in 2010. But I think in 2009, we're going to do something else. We're going to nationalize, privatize, or restructure Fannie and Freddie so that the portfolio issue becomes a secondary one after we know much more profoundly what are we going to do with them.
Is this bailout enough to get the credit crunch at least a little bit unstuck, the larger financial problem?
It should, and so far this morning is moving money, and that's been the huge, huge problem. The cost of funds to Fannie and Freddie went down a lot this morning. If it stays down, and importantly, if Treasury does what it promised and the new GSEs cut their fees, cutting those out, as now will be done, should improve mortgage availability and affordability a lot. At least that's the plan.
Karen Shaw-Petru is the managing partner at Federal Financial Analytics in Washington. Karen, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Almost 70% of Americans own homes. It is practically the symbol of the American dream. But does that sense that we ought to be in the real estate market get us and our financial institutions into trouble? Commentator Gregory Ipp says we ought to decide that before we decide what to do with Fannie and Freddie.
Americans woke up today to learn the federal government had basically taken over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It's one of the biggest government takeovers in history. This moment, though, has been years in the making. We knew these companies were a potentially dangerous hybrid. They are chartered by Congress to promote home ownership, but they are owned by shareholders who want the maximum possible profit. This means that they could take big risks with the knowledge that if they got into trouble, they'd be too important for the government to allow to fail. The Bush administration tried to constrain Fannie and Freddie, just as its predecessor did. But with the support of many in Congress, the companies always fought off these efforts. And then the housing crisis hit. Far from shrinking them, the Bush administration was now forced to ask the companies to expand their role of buying and guaranteeing mortgages because, quite simply, private investors no longer wanted to. Unfortunately, just when the economy needed Fannie and Freddie the most, they couldn't do the job because they had lost so much money on the mortgages they already owned. Treasury says it acted this past weekend to keep the housing and financial markets stable, but it still hasn't answered the question, what role should the government play in home ownership, and do these companies have a part to play? Yes, common stockholders have been punished. They've lost almost their entire investment. And over time, the companies will have to shrink under the terms of the deal with Treasury. But Fannie and Freddie will continue to exist unless and until Congress revokes their charters. And the final decision of the company's fate will rest with the next president and the next Congress. Then there's the question we as a country must answer. How much should we promote home ownership? If we conclude taxpayers should back most mortgages, we must find a transparent and accountable way to do it. It's not at all clear that these companies can accomplish that.
Gregory Ipp is the U.S. economics editor at The Economist magazine. You can send us your thoughts on the Fannie Freddie bailout on our website. That's marketplace.org. Didn't take long for Wall Street to offer its thoughts today. Fannie and Freddie got clobbered, sure, but everybody else thought things were just peachy. The Dow was up 300 points before traders took their second sip of coffee this morning, and interest rates on 30-year mortgages plunged nearly 0.5%. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Given that there's a hurricane on the way, you might say oil traders took it easy on us today. Crude bubbled up just 11 cents this afternoon at the close, a bit more than 106 a barrel as Hurricane Ike makes its way toward the Gulf of Mexico. Bear that price in mind, 106 a barrel, as you consider this. OPEC meets in Vienna tomorrow, and the other two sides of the price triangle are going to be on the agenda. That would be supply and its cousin demand. Today, a couple of cartel members said they think there's too much oil on the market, pushing prices too low. From New York, Ashley Monsite reports.
Some OPEC members want to cut oil production and keep prices high. Juan Pablo Fuentes is an oil economist with MoodysEconomy.com. He says countries like Iran and Venezuela rely on the high price of oil.
It's a way for them to keep their political projects and keep the economy going. They will really face the difficult economic times if oil prices fall below 90 or 100 even.
Still, the real decision lies with Saudi Arabia, says Stephen Lieb. He's CEO of Lieb Capital Management. He says the Saudis will have to please the U.S. and their fellow cartel members.
I think the way they'll negotiate that line is to announce no cut, but at the same time reduce the oil that they are pumping.
An unofficial cut, in other words. OPEC is supposed to pump a certain amount of oil per day. Right now it's pumping about 600,000 barrels a day above that level. Lieb thinks OPEC will simply revert to its original quota. Still, he says demand for oil has slackened to the point where prices could drop to $90 a barrel in the next few months. But that won't last.
We simply don't have the means to increase commodity supplies, oil included, to the extent that the world needs.
He says in the future, China and India will only get thirstier. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Since the Russian invasion of Georgia, relations between Washington and Moscow have become much like they were 15 years ago. Symbolic gestures designed to show displeasure without really saying what you mean. Today, the White House yanked a civilian nuclear cooperation deal with Russia back from Congress. Never mind, lawmakers hadn't even voted on it yet. The cancellation means Russia will lose billions in potential profits. But some American companies aren't too happy either. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The White House unveiled the deal with great fanfare earlier this year. It would have allowed Russia to import spent nuclear fuel from reactors supplied by the U.S. U.S. and Russian civilian nuclear power plants and research facilities could have done joint projects, and Russia could have made billions storing and possibly reprocessing the spent fuel. But times have changed.
The U.S. has been looking around for ways to express its displeasure with Russia.
Charles Kupchin is a Russia analyst at the Council on Foreign Relations. He says Russia isn't the only one who will be hurting. It's not easy for U.S. nuclear power companies to find storage sites.
There aren't many countries that either want to or have the capability of storing and reprocessing nuclear fuel.
U.S. companies will lose out in other ways. Anders Osland of the Peterson Institute for International Economics says the agreement would have allowed them to build nuclear power plants with Russia.
And they could, for example, build nuclear power stations together in third countries. Take, for example, India or China.
It would have been helpful for the U.S. nuclear industry to have collaborated with Russia on any new plants built here. Yelena Sakova is with the Monterey Institute of International Studies.
Russia had put into operation several nuclear reactors in the past 5-6 years.
Sakova says no nuclear reactors have been built in the U.S. in more than 20 years. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up, a tuberculosis epidemic takes flight.
I mean, you take a plane in London today and 6 hours later you're in New York. Technically, you can get tuberculosis if you are sitting around the two rows that a person with tuberculosis might be sitting.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 2.5% today, 290 points to close at 11,510. The NASDAQ ticked up 0.3%, 13 points to finish at 2269. The S&P 500 jumped 2%, 25 points, ended the day there at 1267. Fannie and Freddie, as I mentioned, did not benefit from their bailout news today. Freddie fell 82%. Fannie flopped 89%. Washington Mutual lost 3.5% on news that its CEO has been replaced. Lehman Brothers also ended lower, down 12%. Today, Citigroup had a better day, thank you very much, rising 6.5%. J.P. Morgan jumped nearly 5%. Bank of America popped 7%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.68%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee holds a hearing titled Strengthening the Ability of Public Transportation to Reduce Our Dependence on Foreign Oil. The National Food Policy Conference continues. The two-day agenda focuses on rising food prices. And Harlan Sanders was born on September 9, 1890. During his long life, he was known to most as Colonel Sanders. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Where the candidates stand on the issues is what most of us are going to be looking at when we decide who to vote for this fall. And that kind of stands to reason. Things like health care and tax policy hit us most directly. But seeing as how the president is the government's chief executive officer, what about management style? Kevin Cashman from the talent management firm Korn Ferry International spent some time looking at both Senator McCain and Senator Obama with that standard in mind. Mr. Cashman, good to have you with us.
Well, Kai, it's great to be here.
Take me inside the McCain White House on that first day. What is McCain Incorporated looking like running the White House?
Well, you know, the atmosphere would be very action-oriented. You're going to hear a lot of boiling down things to key principles. You know, what do we really stand for? What are we about? And are we being consistent with those things? And you're going to see kind of a fiery debate atmosphere and so on, and kind of a fiery tenacity interpersonally to get stuff done.
And what about Obama amalgamated come January 20th? What's it going to look like inside that White House?
Well, I think it would be a very different atmosphere. And what's interesting about these two individuals is that they're not only different with policies, they're very different from their leadership approach. You know, Obama's kind of culture and atmosphere would be looking and exploring collaboratively for multiple courses of action.
So you have broken down these two gentlemen's management styles into different categories. You call McCain, you put him in the warrior category. We're going to play a cut from his acceptance speech in St. Paul the other night, and I'm going to ask you sort of to explain what that means.
Fight with me. Fight for what's right for our country. Fight for the ideals and character of a free people.
I guess fight is pretty much the operative word there for the warrior style of management.
Pretty much. When you look at that speech and that last segment, I don't think he captured all of them, but there are at least, you know, 10 fights there. And, you know, this fits McCain's history. You know, he is a warrior. He was a warrior. And his stories are stories of overcoming. They're very much the kind of what we would call I-it stories, how personal power produces results and courage and honor and things along those lines.
All right, let's play some Senator Obama here from a couple of weeks ago in Denver.
This, too, is part of America's promise, the promise of a democracy where we can find the strength and grace to bridge divides and unite in common effort.
And how did you categorize him?
Well, it's different, obviously. It's more of a healer kind of archetype, bringing people together and so on. And his conclusion to his speech was about mending lives and so on. Also, when you analyze the content of the different acceptance speeches, McCain, consistent with a heroic leader, said I almost twice as many times as Obama did.
I can't let you go without asking you about the first NBA president, of course, the incumbent in the White House. There are those who will say, you know what, he did exactly what he promised he would do, delivered on his management style, and there are others who will say his management style really hurt the country. What do you think about that?
Well, you know what I think's interesting? When I view McCain and I view Obama now, they're both demonstrating at least a relatively high level of emotional intelligence, meaning they understand themselves well, and they understand their impact of others pretty well, too. And I really think this is an emerging thing in leadership. And not only with Bush, but with leaders in the past, there's this kind of invulnerability that's presented, you know, to the market or their constituencies, and it really erodes credibility and authenticity over time.
Kevin Cashman at Korn Ferry International. His book is called Leadership from the Inside Out. Mr. Cashman, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks, Kai.
Chances are that when you think about tuberculosis, if you think about TB at all, vague images of it being a problem back in your grandparents' time come to mind. If that's the case, it's time for a refresher because worldwide tuberculosis is back to the tune of more than 9 million new cases a year, with a global price tag for treatment and lost productivity approaching $3 billion. An increasing number of those cases are what's known as multidrug-resistant TB, or MDR. And just like it sounds, MDR-TB is extremely difficult and expensive to treat. It's taken root in parts of Eastern Europe, Romania and Ukraine in particular, which is where Frank Browning went for this first of two reports.
Five days a week, medical aide Dan Bersteau drives through Bucharest's potholed back alleys to fight the TB epidemic, bringing shots and pills to at least 30 different patients.
Now we'll go from one family. Name is Galugaru. And this family have three patients, and this TB is MDR-TB.
Constantino, the father, plus Tatiana and Valentino, both in their 20s. All have been sick with drug-resistant TB since late last year. They live with four other family members in two rooms. Valentino takes daily injections. He pulls down his pants and rolls onto his stomach.
It hurts.
Ah. It hurts. It's terrible.
It will be another year before the three can return to work. We go upstairs to see another man in the same building who's also sick with MDR-TB.
This is a young man and a student.
His name is also Constantino. He fell sick last fall.
The person that gave me the TB is on 7th floor. He's my neighbor.
So life is tough now.
Life sucks now, no.
And what are the effects from the treatment?
When I take them, my stomach hurts. I get dizzy, nausea.
But it was worse for his young neighbor, who quit taking the drugs, developed MDR, switched to herbal medicine, and died. That's the human side of Europe's TB epidemic. Then there's the financial cost for treating MDR-TB.
$200 to $300.
Per patient, per day, estimates health economist Franck Grimard. For the 2 years of treatment, it comes to about $20,000 per person. Much of that treatment is picked up in Romania by the UN Global Fund.
So these are the costs due to the illness itself.
Political disarray has prevented Global Fund support next door in Ukraine, where Grimard estimates that TB costs the country more than $75 million a year in direct health care costs. And then there are also other costs.
If people were not sick, there would actually be better opportunities for these people to contribute to the economy by their spending, by working, by contributing to the national income.
Put another way, Grimard estimates that every 10% reduction in TB caseloads yields about 2% in aggregate economic growth. In short, the hard money benefits would easily surpass the cost of the cure. TB in Eastern Europe, however, wasn't always so bad. TB incidence dropped dramatically under the old Soviet system, but then bounced back threefold following the Soviet collapse. The whole system simply fell apart, says Katia Grazinia, who works with a Seattle-based healthcare company, PATH, that trains doctors and lab techs.
And what we had, especially at the end of the 90s, it's a ruin. Laboratory network, it was not very strong before the end of 80s, but at the end of 90s, it's simply ruined.
In a corridor of Bucharest TB Hospital, doctors Domnica Ciotan and Cristian Didelescu paused to talk about what happened. It wasn't only the collapse of TB care, they said. It was also the effect of massive stress on people's lives caused by the total dysfunction of the whole system. That in turn degraded people's immune systems.
Political stress, stress of life.
Unemployment, divorcing people.
Of course, all that may seem terribly far away to most Americans. But Marcos Espinal, who directs the World Health Organization's anti-TB partnership, says that would be a dangerous illusion.
TB can be acquired in flight of more than 6 hours. I mean, you take a plane in London today and 6 hours later you're in New York. Technically, you can get tuberculosis if you are sitting around the two rows that a person with tuberculosis may be sitting.
Most increases in TB remain among the poor. But a rising proportion of cases, including MDR-TB, are hitting the middle class. Just this spring, New York, San Francisco, and California's Silicon Valley all reported TB increases. As more and more people take to the skies in more and more crowded planes and airports, the prospects are sobering. I'm Frank Browning for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, private money and public health in Ukraine.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, it wasn't only Fannie and Freddie shareholders who had a rough day. As we mentioned, their stock prices plummeted on news of the Treasury Department's rescue plan. But at least they weren't reported to have gone bankrupt, as United Airlines was. Apparently, a paper down in Florida grabbed an old Chicago Tribune story from United's actual bankruptcy back in 2002, slapped a day's date on it, put it online. You can imagine what happened next. Friday afternoon, United closed at $12.30 a share. It was down $11.92 today, $11.92 before trading was stopped. Closed off $1.40. And again, United not bankrupt. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow hiked up 290 points, 2.5%. The NASDAQ rose 13 points, 2/3%. The S&P 500 added 25 points. That is 2% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, online gimmicks update old-fashioned reading.
We really saw that publishing is changing and that we wanted to fit the context of the times that our readers are living in.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.